As part of the FSM 50 at 50, we thought it would be really appropriate to have a panel discussion. We have two wonderful speakers for you this morning, because FSM at 50 really is carrying on as we sang, and as Mario so eloquently put it, that the la lucha continua, the struggle continues. And we brought two people who flew all the way from Washington, D.C. area to be with us, one of whom missed his flight last night and caught a flight this morning. And so I'm going to ask Ben and Martha to please come up. And I think Lynn, did you set it up over here? Was that the idea?
Well, I thought they were going to set it up differently. But,
well, just come up and sit down, and then we can speak from here. So I'm going to introduce folks. And what we wanted to do, we titled this part of the plenary session.
I think they set it up there. That's where it
yeah,
is.
Yeah, but it's kind
too
of far.
It's
yeah,
kind of far.
Just come and sit anywhere up here. Martha, also. And then put them in a jury box. That figures. And then we'll is Martha here?
I'm right here.
Oh, sorry. Come up and sit next to Ben, okay? I was looking for you over on the other side. We wanted to put together this plenary session and carrying it on that talked about the right to live and the right to vote from Selma to Ferguson. And we have brought two speakers for you today to share with us reflections both from the 60s and reflections today on the struggle for voting rights and the struggle against the awful police violence that has been visited upon especially African-American men and within the African-American community. And it really does echo the kind of thing that Mario said at the end there about the five hierarchies and the struggle to overcome them. Our first person, I'm just going to introduce both of them, and then our idea is that they'll each talk about 20 minutes, and then after they talk, I'll come back up, but we'll open it up to a Q&A and comments, things that people want to say, whatever, and they'll respond and so forth, and I think we'll have a lovely session. And I'm very, very grateful to both of them for flying in today to be part of this. Martha Prescott Norman Noonan is a community organizer and activist, has taught and studied history, especially about the civil rights movement. She is co-editor of the book published in 2010 called Hands on the Freedom Plow, Personal Accounts of Women in SNCC. She was a member of SDS and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee field secretary, and she worked in Albany, Georgia, Greenwood, Mississippi, and Selma, Alabama in the 1963 and 64. And it's very great that we have her here to be able to talk with us about those movements. And then we are very grateful for Ben Jealous, who was until recently the CEO and National Executive Director of the NAACP. And some of you probably saw him quite prominently featured. He was running all over the country and still is. He is now affiliated with Caper Capital, headquartered in Oakland, which is a venture capital firm dedicated to socially conscious investing. Ben graduated from Columbia University and the University of Oxford, and I just want to say that I've known Ben a good part of his life because he grew up in Pacific Grove, where I lived for a long time in the 1980s. And Ben, I hope you don't mind my saying this, but one of my fondest memories is our watching, you were still a boy, and I'm a big baseball fan, as you are, and we watched the World Series together on his television set and had a very, very, very good time. So Martha, I think, is going to come up and speak first, and then Ben will follow, and then we'll have our Q&A. Thank you so much. As Martha's coming up, I just want to say Hands on the Freedom Plow is available in the back. It's for sale. Martha brought copies with her, so please avail yourselves of that. I think you'll probably sign them, too, wouldn't you?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, there we go. Okay, Martha Noonan.
Good morning. I want to thank Bettina and Lynn and Robbie for inviting me to be a part of this event. During the 60s, I was a student at the University of Michigan, a member of Voice, a sister organization, and of course, one of the highlights of 1964 was when Mario came to campus to talk about the free speech movement. I want to center my talk about the significance of the vote in the 1960s on the experiences of Southern black women, which takes me back to a 1980s conference in which both Bettina and I participated. Not good. Our remarks were published a decade later in a book from that conference titled African American Women and the Vote, 1837 to 1965. In spite of the age of this conference, I have found myself recently returning to this article because it offers to me the best understanding of what the Southern vote for freedom was all about. And I think for us who have lived through that period, to convey what the 60s voting effort was all about, we need to help today's young people move away from stereotypical thinking about our country, about racial progress, about definitions of racial issues, and our views of the people in economic distress. We need to remind them of the framework in which these two women's efforts to vote took place, that in the 1960s, in the home of the free and the brave, most black men and women living in the deep rural South, as well as in many other southern cities, areas, and towns like Atlanta, could not vote, were completely disenfranchised. And also that black men were fighting to regain a vote, a right that they had lost after Reconstruction. And this runs so counter to most young people's notion that the story of black life and history in this country has been one of increasing progress. Here's a serious loss, which is very relevant today. The other thing is that Southern black politicians from the Black Belt held disproportionate power, both on state and local levels, based on the numbers of black people in their districts. Most of the counties in the Southern Black Belt where we worked had a majority black population, 70 to 80%. And so, of course, state and national districts were based on population. So we usually get bent out of shape with the notion, you know, that the Constitution delineated black men as three-fifths. But really, when the population was evened out, it gave Southern white aristocracy especially far more political power than they had in the past. And it allowed them to be elected year after year. And so that the representatives, the congressional and senatorial representatives coming from Black Belt districts were the most powerful members of Congress and the Senate. They held, they were heads of committee. So short of the president, we were after the people, the most powerful men at that time in the country. Legally, as quite a few folks, of course, are trying to do now, white Southerners stopped black participation at voter registration by a series of laws designed to circumvent the 15th Amendment to the Constitution. Poll tax and subjective questions allowed white registrars wide discretion in dismissing black applicants. It's also worthy noting that in Mississippi and some of the other states, the disenfranchising constitutions of the 20th century served not only to remove black voters from the polls, but also disenfranchised white voters in the aftermath of the populist movement. And of course, the other notion I think that's hard for young people to understand today is that it was basically terrorism that kept black people from the polls. The laws were there, but it was the terroristic activities. So our struggle in the 1960s was one that challenged a good number of the most politically powerful people in the country and required upsetting a system based in terrorism and oppressive in every way, economically, politically, educationally, socially, and physically. And so we need to talk about that in very strong language in terms of power and oppression and leave lightweight words like discrimination and prejudice behind. Now, the two women that I want to talk about, I'm sure most of you have heard about Miss Fannie Lou Hamer, but maybe not the other woman, Miss Georgia May Turner. And I think their struggle to me, and both in the Hands on the Freedom Plow and in the other work that I've done, the thing that's so important to me is keeping alive the voices of people from the 60s, of hearing their stories in their own words. And so this is what I'd like to do today. Both Ms. Hamer and Mrs. Turner spent most of their lives as impoverished sharecroppers. As children, they lived without plumbing, adequate clothing, and went to school or to work without shoes. Ms. Hamer began picking cotton with her family at the age of 6, working 12 to 14 hours a day. After losing the 5 male members of her family to disease during the First World War, Mrs. Turner's family consisted of 4 women. Interviewed in 1960 by future SNCC Executive Secretary Jim Foreman, Ms. Turner described her words in Life That Echo Sojourner Truth and a pattern of work reminiscent of slavery. She said, "I began working in the fields when I was 8. I've been working 50 years. I chopped sorghum, corn, cotton, anything, and I picked. When I first started picking cotton, I couldn't pick but 50 pounds a day. But I kept inching up higher. I started plowing when I was 14 years old because we didn't have no man. I had to do all that plowing and all that rough work to make a living. I have taken an axe and cut wood from about 7 o'clock in the morning until it gets dark in the evening. You ought to see the logs I've hauled. I could hear the bell ring every morning at 5 o'clock for you to get up and feed your mules. I'd be cooking breakfast when that bell rang. Then they rang it a second time for you to go to the fields. You better be there at that hour. Then they'd ring the bell at 12 o'clock for you to come in to dinner and ring the bell at 1 to go back. You didn't need nobody to ring it for you in the evening. My mother did all she could. Some days we had something to eat, some days we didn't. I remember on many days when we went to the blackberry bushes and picked berries off the bushes, washed them, mashed them up with some cornbread, crumble them up, eat them for dinner, then go back to the field and plow a mule until sundown." Both women, especially as adults, were quite conscious of the disparity between their material condition and that of their landowners. Ms. Hamer, for example, lived with her husband Pap in a home in which the landlord had refused to make the plumbing operative. One day when she was cleaning a functioning bathroom in the owner's home and was told this was reserved for the family dog's use, noting the unfairness of the situation and recognizing her family's contribution to the owner's lifestyle, she told her husband, "Now they've got a dog higher than us. We're working and got them setting down, and they're setting down off what we've done for them." Mrs. Turner, a resident of Fayette County, Tennessee, went to register to vote at the end of the summer of 1960. She'd been considering this step the entire summer, but decided best to wait till she received her last sharecropping check in August. Her owner, Miss McNamee, must have also given some thought to timing, because she waited to evict Mrs. Turner until there was a snowfall the following winter. That winter, Mrs. Turner left the home she had lived in for 38 years, unable to find another place to live or work because, of course, they were banned all over the county and nearby counties. She was one of 700 sharecroppers from Fayette and Haywood counties who were similarly evicted, and many of them established a tent city on a black farmer's land where they eked out a marginal existence through 1960 and 1961, relying heavily on private support efforts to meet their basic needs. They were also harassed by night riders. At one time, they shot into her daughter-in-law's tent, and her son-in-law was injured. 2 years later, also in August, Ms. Hamer, a resident of Sunflower County, Mississippi, went with 17 other applicants to the registrar's office in Indianola. She and her husband were immediately evicted from the Marlowe plantation where they had lived for 18 years. 10 days later, white night riders fired 16 times into the Tucker home in Rouville where they had found shelter. Ms. Hamer was one of the few applicants who actually got registered to vote. And basically she threatened the circuit clerk and said, "You can't have me fired. I'm already fired. I won't have to move because I'm not living in no white man's house. And I'll be here every 30 days until I become a registered voter." And after she registered, you know, the night riding continued and so forth. Then early in the summer of the following year, returning from an SCLC citizenship school in South Carolina, headed by Septimer Clock, she and younger women were arrested when some of the members of the group entered the white side of the bus station during a rest stop in Winona, Mississippi. Her companions, including civil rights activists Yvester Simpson, June Johnson, and Annelle Ponder, were badly beaten in the Winona jail, as was Lawrence Guyot, when he went to find out what their bail was. Ms. Hamer received a particularly savage going over. And I have to say, I was in Mississippi when she came into the office to give an affidavit of this account. They forced her to lie down on a bed while two black male prisoners hit her with a wide piece of leather weighted with rock or lead. The first prisoner beat her until he was tired, and then the second took his turn while the other sat on her feet. They beat her, she recalled, until my hands, which she had placed behind her back for protection, were as navy blue as anything you've ever seen, and then beating until I turned black. After which, he noted, I'd been beat till I was real hard, like a piece of wood or something. The white policeman had ordered the beating, saying, "You bitch, we're going to make you wish you were dead." Remembering that day, Ms. Hamer said, "And let me tell you, before they stopped beating me, I wish they could have hit me one more lick that would have ended the misery they had me in." Ms. Hamer was undaunted, though permanently injured by this beating, obviously familiar with the kinds of threats and intimidation that would follow if she continued her work, and aware that her friend Medgar Evers had just been killed for his civil rights work. She took some time to recover, returned to Rouville, and became a full-time secretary for SNCC. Why do this? Why go through all of this? Ms. Turner explained, "The reason I registered is because I want to be a citizen. I registered so my children could get their freedom. I didn't figure it would do me any good." Capturing the entire system of Southern racial oppression in an everyday social interaction, Ms. Turner continued, "I registered for my children so they won't have to stand at the back door like I stood in the rain and cold, and Miss McNamee sat in the front until she got ready to come back to the back and see what I wanted. I'd stand there and look up. Sometimes I'd be so cold I'd be shivering. And sometimes she would come over there and talk to me through the screen, and I would still be in the cold. I come over hard times. I've come over hills and mountains. I wouldn't want none of my children to have to come through it, to run rocking and rolling over the hills and mountains that I came over." Ms. Hamer made it clear that the decision to register to vote did not represent a major change in her life. It was no bolt out of the blue, she insisted. Before the 60s movement, I would get out in the fields, and I was always talking to folks about conditions. Clearly, neither woman was deterred in their attempt to register to vote by the consequences they knew would follow. They moved forward without fear. Ms. Hamer explained, "The only thing they could do was kill me, and they've been trying to do that a little bit at a time ever since I could remember." Ms. Turner was told that she would face hard times if she tried to register. "Well," she said, "I had a hard time before I registered." Hard times, you could have named me that. Georgia May hard times. Using religious imagery, Ms. Turner revealed her understanding of the situation. "I'm depending on the Lord. White people think they got all the power, but they haven't. You know people like that, they can't turn me around. You can drown this old body, but you can't harm my soul. I've gone too far, I'm too old, I've come down too many roads, and I've dug deep. You know what I've got? I've got gold, and it shines in dark places." And there it is. This is how these women and thousands of Southern Black women like them were able to go for broke, risk everything, their jobs, their homes, their lives, to register to vote. Charles Sherrod, director of SNCC's Southwest Georgia Project, looked for these kinds of women when organizing. "There's always a mama," he noted. "She's usually a militant woman in the community, outspoken, understanding, and willing to catch hell, having already caught her share." These women were not worn down or defeated by their hardscrabble existence or left feeling powerless. Rather, they were strengthened and anxious to step forward and fight. And herein lies their contribution, their defining of the civil rights movement. Coping with hard times had created tough, struggle-oriented women long before the 1960s came along. A lifetime of daily struggle against the harshest forms of racism had prepared them for a political struggle to change such conditions. And I always think of our music. There was a culture that supported this struggle, both in oratory and so many of the songs that these women grew up with. We just changed a word or two, if that much, and it turned into a political song. Ms. Turner's words about hard times and indestructible souls, along with her images of hard traveling, wealth, and light, hit the mark. From these women's familiarity with hard times was born an ability to struggle unceasingly and an unconquerable spirit, which were exactly the things that fueled the civil rights movement and kept it going through dark days of intimidation and repression in areas of the county, like Mississippi, long darkened by the shadow of racial oppression. Whatever the physical toll from hard work, deprivation, and punishment had been, these women had endured, and their souls were indeed strong and unharmed. Tested and tried by life experiences, these women had great inner resources. They were rich in the fundamental skills and attitudes necessary for prolonged and difficult struggle. They did bring gold to the movement and made it shine in dark places. I believe it was the genius of SNCC and Miss Ella Baker to build a program based on linking high school and college students with the most oppressed people in our society. We went south not as instructors, not to lead, but to work side by side with community people on terms of equality. It was not a doing for or a giving back. It was not charity work. It was a mutual understanding that we needed each other to make change. We, like Mrs. Turner and Mrs. Hamer, also knew that the campaign to register voters, just like the sit-ins and just like the freedom rides, were not about those targets. We were, in Ms. Baker's words, building vehicles of power to make wider and deeper social change than casting a ballot. Mario Savio grasped this immediately when he participated in the 1964 Summer Project. Professor Robert Cohen notes that virtually all of Savio's letters from Mississippi evoked the liberating ideals of the freedom struggle. In his first letter from Holmes County, Savio wrote, "It's wonderful to be part of such a change for good that's sweeping across the country. The history of the world is pivoting on the internal changes that are going on today in America, and we are in part the agent of that change, a breath of freedom." And this is what Mississippi residents sang about as they went to register to vote and after they returned: freedom. They rejoiced with a church song, which is the basis of the title of Hands on the Freedom Plow. The chorus is, "We are soldiers in the army. We have to fight, although we have to cry. We have to hold up the freedom banner. We have to hold it up until we die." And one of the verses is, "I'm so glad I'm a soldier. I have my hand on the freedom plow. And one day I'll get old and can't fight anymore. But I'll stand here and fight on anyhow." Fight on anyhow.
Well, good afternoon. It is great to be back in Berkeley, indeed. My daughter was born down the street, so I know where I am. But it's great to be back home in Northern California. There are a few places like Northern California on this planet. And while I was sitting there, you know, this was a bit disorienting for me. I was one of four students who were the first students kicked out of Columbia University for our politics in more than 20 years. It had been since the 1970s in SDS and Mark Rudd. The students had been kicked out. And we were in a room that looked almost identical to this, and we had no jury because after the South African divestment protest, they had gotten rid of the jury because they couldn't kick out any students, even though they'd shut down the administration building for 20 days. And in the process, he eviscerated a tradition at Columbia that went back to the wake of the U.S. Revolution of students having a jury by their peers. So it was just kind of ironic to be sitting in the empty jury box for me and a bunch of former student radicals. I would be remiss to say that I'm here with my mom today, who was active in SNCC, who went down to the 10 cities in Tennessee. And who recently published a book, in some ways inspired by the trials of my father, but of course also of many of her friends over the years, called "Combined Destinies: Whites Sharing Grief About Racism." 52 white people's stories about how racism against blacks has hurt their own lives. We were asked today to talk about the right to vote and the right to live from Selma to Ferguson, and I would add, and beyond. I'm going to choose to speak in somewhat abbreviated terms because I'm conscious that I'm speaking to a room of very smart radicals who probably read more newspapers than I do or have time for these days. And so excuse me if I just get to the point. I want to talk for a second about Ferguson, a few minutes about Ferguson, and about this ongoing problem of young black men's lives not being valued enough by enough people in our society. And then I want to talk more about the ongoing assault on the right to vote, because there's a need to shift power in our society if we're going to really change things like young black men's lives being taken down. You know, the other night I was trying to escape sort of all of this. I was over at the Punchline Comedy Club in San Francisco with my dear friend, indeed my godbrother, my godfather's son, Dave Chappelle. And when things got quiet between sets, Dave pulled out his smartphone and showed me a photo of a neighbor of his in Southwest Ohio who just a few days before Ferguson was shopping at the Walmart buying a BB gun for his child. The videotape shows us that while he was leaning on that gun, like using it as a cane, talking to his mother on the cell phone, a police officer came around the corner, confronted him, shot him through, and killed him in the Walmart. Ohio, as Dave pointed out, is a right to carry state. Having a gun in your hand is not provocation. In a state where any citizen for essentially $100 and no felonies can carry a concealed weapon wherever you want. This man was leaning on a BB gun in a Walmart and it scared somebody. And they called the police. And the police officer who showed up is apparently the only one in the area who's killed multiple people and shot the man through before he could get off his cell phone. This is the country that we're living in, where that is possible, and it doesn't really make the national news but for that long. And last week, the grand jury decided they weren't going to bring any charges against the officer. Why do I bring this up? Because I'm concerned that we as progressives, we as movement people, often don't actually take a moment to look deep enough at the problem in front of us to realize actually what we're dealing with. It would be too easy to say, if you will, the only problem with the police is that they're racist. It's not that simple. Most cops aren't. My grandfather was a probation officer. I grew up in an enclave of black law enforcement officers, including one of the first chiefs, black chiefs in New York City in the summers. What you figure out really quickly is that there are white cops who are problems, and there are black cops who are problems, and race and internalized racism might be part of it, but there's something else going on. There's a study I would point you to by a professor named Philip Goss at the University of California at Los Angeles, who's looked into this. He shows, if you ever see his presentations, he shows these live subject studies to actual officers, in this case both white men, one young, one old, confronted with by an actor who's playing a deranged homeless man who happens to be black and wielding a stick. Both these officers have been tested with various types of personality tests. The older white officer tests very low on what the one researcher referred to as aggressive masculinity and very high on implicit bias. To put it in common sort of in the vernacular, he was chill, but he was racist. He was chill, but he was racist. The young white cop tested very low on implicit bias. He probably had black and Latino friends and no real beef, but very high in aggressive masculinity. We would say when I was surfing down in Monterey that he was aggro, right? So you have the chill cop and the aggro cop. The aggro cop isn't racist, the chill cop is. Guess which one kills the homeless black guy? The aggro one, in less than 15 seconds. The racist one who's chill talks him down in about 3 minutes. Not in a very respectful way, I must say, but in a way that values human life. Philip Garr says, sometimes you just need to say the word so that we're clear. The word fag is a deadly word if you are confronted by an officer in our country. If you look at what happens right before an officer gets killed, there's a very high sort of percentage of assaults on the officer's masculinity. In other words, we let too many, not nearly a majority, in this case a distinct minority, but too many insecure bullies onto our police forces. There is a high correlation, actually, when they look at the life histories of officers who kill people between people who were schoolyard bullies and officers who go on to kill people. And so we have to be very clear, and I'll just summarize my comments. If you ask, what can we do about things like Ferguson, this killing of our young people, one, we actually need personality tests for our officers. We need to weed out those who have any type of decent biases, absolutely, but we also have to weed out the bullies before we give them a gun. Two, we need national use of force standards and national standards for use of force training. In England, where the majority of officers do not carry a gun, they are required to be trained in use of force every 6 months, and they have national standards. In our country, standards vary state by state, and standards for training vary locality by locality. While some big cities, through lawsuits, have been forced to do regular use of force training, most localities in our country, the standard is you are trained once, and that is on one day at the academy, 8 hours, not eight like academic hours, 8 hours in the day, once. And finally, we have to absolutely stop and confront those who would evangelize about the wisdom of racial profiling, like Mayor Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York City. Mayor Giuliani, who many of us found much more easy time to sort of demonize, when Amadou Diallo was killed, was racial profiling about 70,000 people a year under his old street crimes unit. And they pulled off about 700 guns from those 70,000 people. Mayor Bloomberg, before we at the NAACP joined with others to confront him and ultimately bring 70,000 people to his house on a silent march on Father's Day. Why don't you all come down to Mike's house for Father's Day? Was his stop and frisk program was stopping 700,000 New Yorkers and pulling off 700 guns a year. 10 times greater as far as the humiliation of citizens in New York City, and really not one more gun. And finally, we have to deal with the issue of mass incarceration, which is that giant sucking sound that's sending these officers out there, shoving their hands in young people's pockets, looking for a joint so they can bust them. In our country today, a black man is 3 times more likely to be incarcerated than in South Africa at the height of apartheid, when South Africa was the world's leading incarcerator. And a white man in America today is 3/4 as likely as that black man in South Africa at the height of apartheid. And if that's what racial privilege gets you, 25% discount on the state of blacks and the criminal justice system during apartheid, I would say we're all in trouble. Which brings me to the issue of Selma and voting and how we get beyond all of this in many ways. Quick little calisthenic exercise. Raise your hand if you descend from somebody at some point in your family's history who was a landless white man, a white man who didn't own any land. Somebody would have told you he was broke. All right? Keep your hand raised. Raise your hand if you descend from a former slave or Native American or a Chicano. Keep your hand raised. Everybody keep your hands raised. Raise your hand if you descend from a woman. This is easy. Everybody should raise their hand. All right. That's right. That's right. But even you, Bettina, I met your mom. Everybody talks about your dad. I met your mom. Why do I mention that? Because it's important for us to realize in this country where the founders and the framers wholeheartedly objected, at least the ones in power. Thomas Paine would not have objected, but John Adams did, to the notion that the Revolutionary War privates would be allowed to vote. Where John Adams said to the notion, yes, of course, we're not going to let our wives vote, and of course, we're not going to let the Negroes vote, but the privates in the Revolutionary War who won the war, no, we're not going to let them win either. And then when they said, why not? He said, because that would be mobocracy, not democracy. And then he gave the tell that's continued to be used right up to this moment, which is this lie about voter fraud, widespread voter fraud. John Adams said, oh, well, because you see, they're landless, and so they can rove from town to town and steal elections wherever they go. And so it went. Why won't we let women vote? We won't let women vote because, and I believe this actually, although this is purely anecdotal in my experience, defies the gender dynamic in most households. My wife, my mother, all both felt comfortable telling me how to vote. I don't think I've ever told either one of them how to vote. They said, well, a man with a wife would have two votes, and that would not be fair. Why do we need the poll tax? We need the poll tax because a man who doesn't have money to pay the poll tax is so poor his vote could be bought. Why do we need the literacy test? Because a man who could not pass the literacy test does not read well enough for his mind to be his own. He could be too easily influenced. And on, right up to voter ID. In this country where you are more likely to know somebody who has been struck by lightning twice in the same place than you are to have witnessed a case of prosecutable voter fraud. Now, why is this so important at this moment in history? Because those laws that so many of you were fighting against 50 years ago, that Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner were assassinated fighting 50 years ago, were put in place about 50 years or more before that. In other words, it's been more than a century than we've seen our nation, so-called land of the free and the home of the brave, actually get back into the dirty, nasty work of passing new laws to suppress the vote. And why is that happening? Because there is a change happening in our country. And quite frankly, the other side, those who would fear that they have too much to lose from that change, have figured out something that we haven't figured out yet. Yeah, we know, we'll agree with them that, for instance, this nation will be a nation of minorities only. Some people say it'll be a majority-minority nation. I'm like, what does that mean? Right. We're all minorities, right. So that's what that means. As of 2043. What we haven't internalized as progressives yet is what that means is that every demographic trend in this country is in our favor for the next half century or more. And that is why folks who play for keeps, like the Koch brothers, are willing to spend almost any sum to support groups like ALEC, Americans for Prosperity, and ultimately pushing policies to suppress the vote. My personal theory is not that, you know, is it quite simply that David and Charles Koch just don't want to see the change happen before they die. My personal commitment is to make sure that it does. And so what do we do about it? Well, in recent years, we've spent millions of dollars supporting lawyers to bring lawsuits, advocates to push policies. And then as we were preparing to celebrate Freedom Summer, it occurred to me that your generation showed us what the antidote was 50 years ago. The only antidote to massive voter suppression is massive voter registration. The only antidote to massive vote suppression is massive voter registration. There's a report you can download off the Center for American Progress's website that I produced earlier this summer called True South. It shows you, state by state, what the balance of power is in the Black Belt. And then, state by state, what percentage of the Black or people of color vote, we show both numbers, would need to be registered to change the balance of power in that state. So, for example, Georgia, the balance of power is about 250,000 to 300,000 votes, depending on whether you look at gubernatorials or presidentials. And there are 830,000 unregistered black people and people of color in Georgia right now. And if you signed up about 600,000 of them, you would flip the balance of power in the state. In North Carolina, the balance of power is about 25,000 votes. You only need to sign up about 50,000. In South Carolina, it's in between. The balance of power is about 100,000 votes. You need to sign up about 200,000. You take the number that you hit, in other words, that defines the balance of power, you multiply it by two, and that's about what you need to get to. And different states have different rates, but it's a good kind of back of the envelope. You then take that and you multiply it by $25, and that's what it would cost you. In other words, we can flip the balance of power in Georgia for about $15 million. We can flip the balance of power in South Carolina. And organizing costs money. I know we like to pretend like it doesn't. It does. The balance of power in South Carolina for about $5 million. We can flip the balance of power in North Carolina for about $1.5 million. And the question to be asked is, why aren't we doing it? I want to talk to you for a second about what victory looks like on the other side. You see, I live in a state called Maryland. It's the state that my mom grew up in. My mom desegregated her high school in Maryland in 1955. The state had delayed a year. Maryland, in other words, was just as drenched in segregation and before that slavery as any other state in the South. It's below the Mason-Dixon. It is the state that both Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman ran away from. You wouldn't know it today. We are on the verge of having our first black governor. It is a very tight race. I would encourage you to pay attention to it, because the other side has figured out what's at stake. You see, in 2012 in Maryland, we were dealing with folks we're dealing with all across the country. We had an insurgent right wing, been sort of emboldened for a couple of years since the rise of the Tea Party in 2010, and they were pushing for all sorts of changes. And at the very least, in a state like Maryland, the Democrats have control by a thinner margin than the most realize. They were at least trying to stop everything that we were doing. And so they were pushing to assault the rights of immigrants, assault the rights of women, assault the rights of trade unions, assault civil rights, expand gun owners' rights. And that year in Maryland, we became the first state below the Mason-Dixon to abolish the death penalty. We passed the DREAM Act. We passed marriage equality, also the first time south of the Mason-Dixon. We expanded voting rights, and we passed sensible gun safety reform. That is why the right wing in the South is fighting so hard, because they know the geography and the reality of the South better than most. Maryland sits just above Virginia, which blinks blue and red, and just above North Carolina, which blinks blue and red. And those aren't too far above Florida that blinks blue and red. And it is possible for us to actually imagine a much more progressive eastern seaboard of the entire South, and it would cost about $20 million. And that may sound like a lot of money to you. It sounds like a lot of money to me. And then you remember that Obama's campaign was $2 billion. 1%. And we changed the reality of the country. I mean, imagine if Republicans couldn't take South Carolina, North Carolina, Virginia, and Georgia for granted. What the conversation would be like in this country right now. Imagine if redistricting in 2020 was handled by Democrats in states with majority black Democratic parties. Imagine how much closer, in other words, our country would be to the world that all of us in our idyllic, in our greatest, most idealistic moments as young activists believed it would be soon and very soon. But this is the other thing that the right wing has figured out that we, I don't think, are really paying enough attention to, which is that the barrier between poor blacks and poor whites in the South is growing increasingly thin. mass incarceration, mass unemployment, the impact of massive foreclosures have all impacted people's sense of urgency about their children's access to the American dream. We don't have many, we have some. We don't have enough real Southern historians in the progressive movement in this country. The great black civil rights lawyer, and I'll kind of close on this, said, A. Leon Higginbotham said, before a young lawyer steps in the court, he or she should know at least 300 years of American legal history, because all of it will come to bear in that courtroom. And so it is for any organizer. So I was standing with Reverend Charles Sherrod, preparing for a big march in his field and at his new plantation down in Albany, Georgia. Talk about a Jobian story, right? It's pretty incredible. And we were talking about that history. And, you know, this year is the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer and the free speech movement. Last year was the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act. Next year is the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act and the assassination of Malcolm X. Last year was the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. It was also the 350th anniversary of the rebellion at Gloucester, Virginia in 1663. If you haven't read your Howard Zinn recently, go back. It's early in the book. And what Professor Zinn reminds us is that that rebellion was sort of notable in our hindsight, and yet not unique at the time, because it was white indentured servants and black slaves standing up together. Why? Because the governor had passed on a note from the king who had made a decree that essentially could be summarized as, "And your status shall convey to your children." So if you were a slave and say were freed, well, your children would remain slaves. And if you were an indentured servant and served out your time, your children who were born during that period would remain indentured servants. Indeed, they would typically remain until they were 18 and then have to earn off their childhood. In other words, from the very beginning, from the earliest days of the American experiment, we have been willing to endure a lot until we reach the point that we are informed one way or the other that our children will have no hope higher than achieving what we have already achieved. That they will be stuck in the same status as us. And then it's game on. And when you walk into a prison anywhere in the South, what you are quickly kind of hits you in the face is that the descendants of the penal colonies and the descendants of slaves are there shoulder to shoulder. Descendants of indentured servants and descendants of slaves are there shoulder to shoulder. There are 1 million black men in prison in this country. We talk about that a lot. There are also 1 million white men in prison in this country. And those million white men tend to come from the same class. It is possible for us, in other words, to turn this ship of state we call our nation around soon and very soon. But we have to internalize what the right has already figured out, that we are the ones in power. We need to stop feeling helpless. We need to remember what your generation taught us, that we have the antidote to vote suppression. It's called massive, not typical, but massive voter registration. And we have to understand that this thing that we call the status quo can be changed overnight, if we are willing to act like the future is as valuable as we know it is, and the freedom that we would win in the process for our children and grandchildren, born and unborn, is as valuable as holding on to the status quo is for Charles and David Koch. Thank you, and God bless.
Thank you, Ben, and thank you, Martha, very much. Let's give them another round, huh? One of the stories, what we're going to do is we're going to bring this table down, and then they can sit at it, and we can have some Q&A for a little while before we go to lunch. I wanted to say something about the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms. I was reminded of this with the story about the terrible killing of the black man in Walmart, and National Rifle Association, and everything about the right to bear arms. And two things about it. It was the right to raise a militia during the Revolution. I'm talking about the American Revolution, right? But there were two reasons for it. One was for a popular militia in order to confront the British. But the other reason was for a popular militia in order to carry out the genocide against Native Americans. That's what the Second Amendment was about. It's worth thinking about that. And when the National Rifle Association president talks about the right to bear arms, he is not talking about the right of black men to bear arms. He's talking about the right of white propertied men to bear arms, which is part of Ben's point about property, right? Property ownership. So I just thought of that because, I've been thinking about these things. It's just interesting. And then, you know the term Redskins? The Washington Redskins? And they've been trying to get them to change their name because it's so racist, and they refuse. You know where the term Redskins comes from? I didn't know until I saw something on the internet from a new book by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, who's a wonderful scholar and activist, lives in the Bay Area. And it had to do with after killing Native Americans and as they were killed, whipping them and literally shredding their skin so they looked like red skin. That's where the term came from. It's a term that denotes genocide against Native Americans. This country is a lot, you know, just a lot. You know the Yiddish term chutzpah? Those of you that don't, it's almost untranslatable, but it means something like they've got their nerve, you know, but that doesn't really catch it. In any event, we've had these wonderful speakers, and they're right up here, and please feel free to, I'll stay up here and recognize people and ask questions, and we'll have a little bit of a dialogue. Please go ahead.
A couple of unarmed black men or boys are killed, and I believe the statistic right now is about 100 each year in the United States, that 100 unarmed black men and boys. I'm going to think about that a long time that you said it was the bully personality. But my question for you is if we see that as the tip of an iceberg where most of the racism is hidden under the surface, in some ways it's harder now because before at least we knew what was going on. And this is for either one of you. Comments?
Yeah, no, look, you know, I the signs that race is still a problem, that's still a barrier to social inclusion, are sort of all around us, right? Like out here in the Valley, there's been a lot of conversation about the, finally the Silicon Valley firms have stopped suing to stop the release of their EEO-1 data. They have been saying it was a trade secret, that their diversity stats were a trade secret. Turns out they all have the same diversity stats. And which is about 1% of their programmers, their engineers are black, for instance. You know, sometimes 1 or 2% are Latino. Programming staff, it might be double that, so 2% or 3%. The killing of young black men, I think, is probably the sort of the clearest and most glaring. But you know, you also have the case of Troy Davis and many other things that have kind of called our attention. I guess I have a few thoughts on that. You know, one is, we need to keep sort of agitating the country to come to grips and to figure out new ways beyond what is a very old problem in this country. The other is that we really have to spend a lot of time talking to young people to help them interpret what's happening to them. I fear as I sit with young people that too many of them actually just take it personally. I think it's a personal failing every time that they don't get a job. And they don't think about anything else that might be a factor. Or if one of their friends gets into an altercation with the police, is confronted, and you know they're quick to find fault with that friend. Even in New York City, where there were 700,000 a year, right? And I've talked with girls who are literally ballerinas on their way down the block who've been frisked. But I also worry that the economic divide in our country is actually distancing black leadership, traditional black leadership, if you will, and certainly blacks of means from the poor side, typically, of our own families, in ways that will have profound implications for creating a permanent underclass. Because we have taken for granted, since our existence in this country, that we basically all lived in the same place. And yet we are only two generations, because of when desegregation occurred, we're two generations behind whites in the suburbanization and nuclearization of our families, at least of our more upwardly mobile families. And we will soon be at a point where the wealthy side of the black family, of a black family, doesn't know the poor side. And that is a very dangerous time. And in many ways, we're already seeing the impact of that, in as much as since Dr. King has died, the black upper middle class has quadrupled in this country. And the percentage of blacks living in poverty has not gone down one inch.
Martha, did you want to say anything? No? Okay. I saw there's a woman over here. The woman behind you that had the floor first. You bring her the mic. No, she's standing right here. I'm just trying to recognize people with their faces.
All right, is this right? You can hear me?
Yeah.
All right, I just wanted to add a footnote to the history of Fannie Lou Hamer that a lot of people have probably forgotten, and I think our speaker might not have known about. In this, I was on Berkeley SNCC. I was a member of Berkeley SNCC with Mario. And in the spring of 1965, we had a committee that organized a Human Rights Week. And we brought Fannie Lou Hamer here. She was one of the first people to take advantage of our newly won rights. And she spoke on the steps of Sproul Hall. So I wanted everybody to remember that.
For one or both of you, what is the most efficient and effective way each one of us here today can encourage massive voter registration?
There's someone over there with a mic already from with the first.
Anyway. Okay.
Yes, look, the most efficient and effective way at this point really would be to read and circulate that report that I mentioned and get friends talking about what can be done. You can do it in a city. I mean, if you talk about Ferguson, for instance, there's a lot of people talking about massive voter reg in Ferguson right now. But ultimately, we need trade unions, women's groups, Emily's List, Now, civil rights organizations, the Democratic Party, to ultimately decide that it is a priority, that it's worth missing a few campaign ads to invest.
Right.
If Michelle Nunn wins in Georgia this fall, it will be because of the New Georgia Project, which is led by a woman named Stacey Abrams. Stacey is the first woman to ever lead a party in the Georgia legislature, the first black in the lower house. She's the daughter of civil rights activists. She's 40 years old. Stacey has taken it upon herself to register more than 120,000 Georgians. Of that, 830,000 this year. The Secretary of State 2 months ago spoke to his fellow Republicans in Georgia and said he was worried about the impact that the massive voter registration in Georgia would have on the fall elections, specifically Jason Carter's attempt to become governor and Michelle Nunn's attempt to become senator. About a month and a half later, Stacey noticed that they hadn't filed most of the, they had not processed, the Secretary of State, that same Secretary of State, Brian Kemp, had not processed most of the voter registrations that had been turned in as of May. This was just a couple of weeks ago. And so she submitted a, basically the Georgia equivalent of a Freedom of Information Act request to find out what the status was on the voter registrations. That was on a Friday. The following Monday, he subpoenaed all of her records and began the process of charging them with voter fraud. In this online, you'll be able to find in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution on Friday op-eds by Julian Bond and by Secretary Kemp. There is now a fierce battle happening in Georgia over these voter registrations. As Bond basically makes the point in that op-ed, and he and I are for this purpose, if you will, of pushing massive voter registration, resurrecting a group he founded coming out of SNCC called the Southern Elections Fund. He makes the point that the Secretary of State's basically first he sought to essentially resist the massive voter registration. Now he's trying to distract people from it, trying to make sure that people are not signed up in time for early voting. So if there's anything that you can do right now, it is either influence organizations that you're involved in to start getting ready to support massive voter registration for 2016. But if you really are just looking for support for a way to have an impact in the next couple of weeks, any support you can send to the New Georgia Project is sorely needed. They are right on the front line. They've decided to take it on. They're doing an incredible job, and they're being attacked for it as we speak.
Okay, now, who's holding the microphone in the back there? Go ahead.
My name's Jeff Klein. I was at Berkeley in 64 and, you know, naive young and stood up. And listening to the issues that you've both raised, I thought it was ironic as I walked up to Bolt, there's 100,000 people, it seems like, going to a football game. So my question to you is, separate from money, is what about the sports and entertainment figures, particularly from the black community? They're powerful rap artists, hip-hop artists, and sports legends. They actually are very wealthy, and they have a huge public. And asking them, imploring them to stand up the way our brothers in the Black Panthers did and stand up in front of these asshole, you know, racist secretaries of states and make songs about it and rally the youth and encourage young people to register and protest.
Look, I think the sort of role model for them would be Harry Belafonte, Sidney Poitier, Ruby Dee, Ozzie Davis, and so forth, Cicely Tyson. In recent years, Mr. Belafonte has really taken it upon himself to begin convening artists and trying to sort of pass on that tradition in a very intentional way. And there are some like Rosario Dawson and others who have really taken up the mantle. What I would say is that there are hopeful signs. I mean, just recently, I think about 2 weeks ago, at a big concert here in California, Jay-Z, who's probably the most powerful rapper on the planet, stopped from the usual program to endorse Prop 47 and talk about the need to shrink California's prison system. And so there are signs, and those of us who work on the other side, including activists who I've mentored who are involved in making sure that Jay-Z made that comment, who are working on that. But we also, I think, need to, you know, all of us who were student activists, and it's now been 20 years since my student activist days, so I can speak with some wisdom and distance. And especially those of you who you know, are celebrating the 50th anniversary of your movement, if you're not as active then, now as you were then, remember the, sort of the generational, the dual generational imperatives of life in this country. The activists only come from two generations, typically. Those in or around university age and those near or above retirement age.
Right.
And so if you aren't as active today as you were then, please get active because we need you again. Thank you.
Yeah. Martha, I just want to add. Martha, do you want to add something? Okay. Go ahead.
My name is Joe Freeman. After I graduated from Cal in 1965, I went to work for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. I spent most of the next year in Alabama working on voter registration. We were aiming to have a big victory in the 1966 Alabama primary. We registered over 100,000 voters with a little help from the feds. We did not have a big victory. We didn't because the whites out-registered us. Indeed, in January of 1966, Governor Wallace placed a postcard in the hands of every student in a white school telling them to take it home to their parents and urge their parents to register to vote. I could name you many other things they did. I love your idea of registering enough voters in Georgia, North Carolina, and South Carolina to flip the state. But I also know from the year that we spent trying to have a major impact in the Alabama primary that for every action, there is a reaction. For every movement, there is a counter movement. How do we register enough voters to overcome the inevitable impetus that our efforts will have to bringing the Koch brothers to pour money into those states to out-register us?
So there's a couple of things at play there. One is that the experience you had in Alabama in the mid-60s was a special place even amongst Deep South states, right? The NAACP had been ruled a terrorist organization. Strength of the movement in many ways in Alabama has still to this day never quite recovered. But you also had an investment in counter voter registration that was not uniform throughout the South. And more importantly, in recent decades, they've never been able to duplicate. So, for instance, in Florida in 2012, where they passed massive voter registration laws saying that that would secure the presidential election in Florida for the Republicans, Obama won. He won by 70,000 votes. The NAACP registered 120,000 voters, and several other organizations also signed up tens of thousands in that state. We did so despite the fact that on Martin Luther King Day that year, the Tuesday after, rather, when we showed up to turn in our voter registration forms, sheriffs were waiting for us across the state, threatening to throw literally the senior citizens who are the vanguard of the NAACP into jail because they had passed a new law saying that if a voter registration form was out of the county clerk's office for more than 48 hours, which it can only
That's
be
right.
over a holiday weekend, you would do jail time or pay a fine of $50 per form, and we take out thousands. And that was enough to get several name brand organizations to stop voter registration in Florida for that year while they filed a lawsuit, which conveniently invalidated the law just a few weeks before the state election. They also could have engaged in voter registration. They didn't do that. And in fact, their own laws have made some of them afraid of showing massive voter registration. But The other thing that's different now versus then is that the numbers are different, and the numbers increasing will be on our side. If you take a state like Mississippi that I know much better, it's 39% black, it's about 5% Latino, and whites are increasingly in small numbers drifting back over to the Democratic column as they're getting frustrated with the economic impact of some of the Republican policies. The basic strategy is once you do massive voter registration, even if you only get away with it once, you then control things for 2 years. You pass voting rights enhancements, early voting, same-day registration, but you also unleash. And the thing that I would point out is that, you know, is that the since that year, despite the frustration that you had, black power in Alabama has generally gone up as a percentage, and it's going to keep going up. So, again, it is easy for us to look, I guess I'll summarize it this way, at the experience of Reconstruction and the experience of the New South and say that progressives in the South are two-time losers and why should we have faith again? What is different today are the numbers. That's why they have decided for the first time in more than a century to invest in voter suppression. If they could dominate those states for the foreseeable future through voter registration, there would be no need to invest in voter suppression. And so if we take hope from nothing else, let us take hope from our opponent's fear. They are going to extreme measures to hold on to the balance of power for a reason. And it's because they have looked at the numbers, and the numbers are not in their favor.
Ben,
I just want to say we have time for probably a couple more. Okay. You know, one here and one more over here. Go ahead.
Ben, I was at the Freedom Summer celebration, so I heard a lot about the moral Monday
yes.
movement, and that model, which is to organize around values and not be party specific, I wanted you to comment on. And also, I'm a member of the Progressive Caucus of the Democratic Party, and I'd like to ask your opinion on why the hell the Democratic Party doesn't wise up and pour $15 million out of that or $2 billion and take power.
You got the money.
Yeah, with regard to the latter, I'm now working with a number of influential folks to help them just do that. It's just become ridiculous. You know, they say poverty is the surest form of historic preservation, and the systematic starving of organizing in the South by the Democratic Party for about 40 years has kind of wrought what we have now, and they need to shift. When you're looking at building multiracial voter coalitions in today's South, issues are the way to do it. The traditional barriers in the South are race and religion and within states region. And the way that you get beyond that is by focusing on issues. You look at right now in Mississippi, Derek Johnson, who runs the NAACP, but also the old kind of black PACs that are legacies really from the SNCC era in Mississippi, has teamed up with one of the former New South governors of the state, and they're pushing a referenda to put education as a right into the state constitution. And it's one of the easiest things in all corners of the state, black or white, to get people to sign. And there's a real sign that, if you will, and what they're trying to do is to build a coalition where people get comfortable voting together, white and black, on issues, and then perhaps to find common cause in other ways in politics as well.
Okay, over here.
Yes, I listened carefully to your presentation, and I certainly understand that it is significant and important that people vote, etc. And we, but see, I think there is something fundamentally wrong with the way you're looking at this. When you say, well, that's why we're here,
yeah,
to talk. Look, when you say, if I had $15 million, we could alter the political balance. Well, hold on a minute. I remember a quote by Dr. King where he said, look, now we have the right to vote, but what we need is something to vote for. Okay. So when you say, what good is it to have more people voting if all we can vote for is corporate-owned candidates? That is really the problem, because we just had a forum, you know, here in Oakland where we had a SNCC, you know, militant talk about his past. He was in the Freedom Summit. And he pointed out, he said, look, he got $12 a week. A week for working for SNCC at that time. $12 a week. Well, why is it then that they had such success in mobilizing and organizing? It was the will of the people to vote that made that difference. I would argue that our will to vote is eroded and demoralized by candidates who do not represent our interests. So it's not simply a matter of money. I think that's a mistake. to look at it that way. If you look at that situation in North Carolina, which I'm sure you know all about, here's a situation where people have been struggling and therefore feel more motivated to work. You have to build the struggle. People have to have a program to get behind. People have to have leaders that they can trust and they believe are actually up to some good. Right? I'm serious. To motivate them to want to vote. Once people want to vote, oh, let me tell you, they can't stop us from voting. But when people are demoralized because they feel that these so-called Democrats are not qualitatively different from the Republicans, that's our experience, and you know, you understand all of this, I think that undercuts our ability to be effective. Because this is not simply a matter of race, as you said, and I agree with you, but it's also a matter of class interests. You know, and there's nobody, and I'll say that clearly, nobody representing the interest of working people. And that's the thing I think that is most different about this country from, let's say, the countries in Europe or all over the world, where there are parties that at least claim to represent the interest of the working people, Labor Party, you know, Social Democratic, or whatever. We don't have that here. And consequently, we get stuck with these two parties that are so similar. I don't know. You know, I don't see the difference. Right?
We had social democrats here once. As I recall, it's ancient history for me. I wasn't born yet, but I recall they supported Nixon over McGovern, or at least stayed out because of their bread and guns policy. But look, in other words, even if we had the parties of Europe, I think those of us who are very smart and well-educated and sit around hashing up ideas all the time would find many faults with them. We tend to, I think, in this kind of MSNBC izing of progressive politics, focus on what MSNBC, for example, focused on, which is like national conversations a lot. National politicians, senators, governors, statewide politicians. When you organize in Mississippi, and I was an organizer not in the 60s when I wasn't born, but in the 90s when the governor was trying to turn a college into a prison. And we stopped him. Literally turned Mississippi Valley State University into a prison. What you quickly figure out is that people's lives are determined by who's on the county board of supervisors, who's on the city council, who's the mayor, who's the sheriff, who's the district attorney? Who's the sheriff? And so right now, because we're stuck in this stalemate in many of these southern states, where on the one hand you have enough voters to shift the balance of power, say in North Carolina where it's 25,000 votes, or South Carolina where it's 100,000 votes, or even Georgia where it's 250. And somebody says to you, well, if I sign up to vote, will this really make a difference? You can only say yes if you're aiming to sign up hundreds of thousands of people to vote. And so I don't think that the money by itself changes anything other than the balance of power. And once that is changed, then it's up to us to run for seats that we couldn't win before, to dream in ways we haven't let ourselves dream in a long time, and to change things. But what I can tell you is that when you look back over the last 50 years, a lot has changed. When you and those voters who we signed up to vote in Florida, who understand in part because we got their emails and we communicate with them, that Obama couldn't have won without them, and understand what that means in a state like Florida, and how many, therefore, city council members got elected and mayors got elected. And you now have somebody like Alvin Brown, who was bashed as the NAACP candidate, who's been the mayor of Jacksonville, a deep, sort of like a deep Georgia city that happens to be in Florida, with a 75% approval rating, and he's in charge of the police force. So, you know, I would say respectfully that there are a lot of good candidates that whose names we don't know but whose local folks know them, that will excite them to turn out to vote. There are many more who will run if they feel like this time it's different. Those of you who are around for Freedom Summer and the organizing that went on throughout the mid-60s and even into the 70s understand what it's like when something is different for the first time. For my generation, it was the Jackson campaigns of 84 to 88 and the way that that changed, say, cities like New York City or states like Virginia. For this generation, it's the Obama campaign. And yet, despite all of those efforts, Georgia is still too much like the way you might remember it, especially if you're outside of Atlanta. Mississippi is still too much like the way Mississippi's always been. And the danger is in us, those at the sort of active dreamer edge of the progressive movement saying, our dreams aren't big enough for Mississippi or Georgia or South Carolina. We can't imagine those states changing. That's why we dug into the numbers, and the numbers speak for themselves. The balance of power in North Carolina is 25,000 votes. The balance of power in South Carolina is 100,000. Georgia, it's 250,000. This room could change that if we wanted to.
Okay, I'm very mindful of time. So we got Lynn here, and this, I don't know your name, but over here. Oh, Rachel, hi. We correspond on all the time. This is email where you don't know what somebody looks like. Okay, go ahead, Lynn.
Excuse me. My name is Mario, too. And I object to this instance of white liberal arrogance.
Excuse
if not
me.
Racism. Because when I was in line behind this fellow, Lynn abruptly squeezed herself between us.
So go ahead. Go ahead.
And I said, excuse me, Lynn, you're cutting in front of me. And she said, you're right, I am cutting in front of you. And people here hopefully saw it, because she claimed that she raised her hand the same time this gentleman
did. Fine, just go ahead. Just go ahead.
Not realizing, as this woman over here could attest, that I raised my hand long before he did. Now, she gets plenty of time to talk.
Just go ahead. Go ahead and ask your question. Or make your comment to the speakers, please.
Okay.
Just go ahead.
Part of my comment to the speakers.
Thank you.
I was originally going to leave this off and ask Ben Jealous another comment. But I've discovered since being in the Bay Area for 15 years in Berkeley that there's often not much tolerance or consideration for free speech on the left from the left. And there's an awful lot of white liberal arrogance and white liberal racism from someone who gets to speak all the time, whereas an ordinary black person rarely gets a chance to speak. Someone who betrayed Mario Savio's memory, someone who lost track of the meaning of Mario Savio when she invited warmonger Christopher Hitchens to be the keynote address at a Mario Savio event, someone who signed a letter condemning not Netanyahu and Israel's oppression of the Palestinians, but people who went to protest Netanyahu and Israel. Barbara Lubin of Middle East Children's Alliance and I. This is not a personal
attack.
You know, this is a problem on the left, too.
I want to know what your question is to Ben or Martha.
Okay, I will ask them, why is it that every time you criticize an icon, major or minor, on the left, it is considered taboo by members of the left? You know, some of us on the left who criticize the Israel lobby were often prevented from criticizing the Israel lobby on the left by people like Lynn Hollander Savio. It took two mainstream, at the time, light imperialist professors at the time, I think they've changed since now, named Mearsheimer and Walt, to break the logjam on the left from being able to criticize the power and influence of the Israel lobby.
All right.
This is what I, as a black man, find on the left. Now, my question, which I wouldn't have had to go through all of that if there weren't this instance of white liberal arrogance. Thank you very much. Because this so rarely gets a chance to be said, and the white left needs to examine itself on this. I wouldn't have had to have gone through all of that if she hadn't done that. So now, if I just take the time for the question that I would have asked a black perspective to a black man about especially black people, Mr. Jealous, my apologies for the digression. A lot of black people, especially black youth, as well as youth of all colors, voted for Obama. And they've been sorely disappointed. My concern is that these voter registration drives are usually a guise, or seem usually to be a guise, for Democrat Party voter registration drives, in which we get black politicians who shy away, especially like the Congressional Black Caucus, and is often criticized by Glenn Ford of Black Agenda Report at blackagendareport.com. Everyone should regularly read it. Black politicians who are timid to criticize the police, as Obama himself often has been. So next time, if the expected nominee, Hillary Clinton, is going to be the nominee, are we all supposed to vote for her? And the last thing I'll say, because older blacks often talk about things have changed over 150 years. Well, I hope to hell things have changed over 150 years, okay? Or older blacks often criticize younger black voters for saying, ain't a damn thing changed. Those younger black voters don't mean ain't a damn thing changed in your lifetime or in 150 years. Are you going to follow Lynn now? Why don't you shut up and listen to someone? This is why this room is overwhelmingly white, because of people like you. I'm about to wrap up, so let me wrap up, and you stop piling on with your white liberal arrogance. This is why this room is overwhelmingly white. Well, let me wrap up and shut the fuck up. So we get another white arrogant interruption as I was literally on my last sentence.
Go ahead, finish your
sentence,
please.
They mean ain't a damn thing changed in their lifetimes. And indeed, if you go to some of these, not only black neighborhoods in the city, but black neighborhoods in small towns, things have gotten worse over the past 30 years. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, look, if you look at incarceration stats, they have gotten worse. If you look at poverty stats, they haven't gotten better. We will never know, with that said, what would have happened in the Obama administration in this country if in 2009 and 2010, those of us who all came together to help with this historic election in 2008 stayed on the battlefield and remembered what we all learned as young organizers, which is that you do not help put somebody into office to make the change for you. You put them into office to make it a little bit easier for your movement to keep making change happen.
Obama's made it harder.
And
Obama's passed laws and to make it harder.
Excuse me. And the sort of infighting that we saw on the left when we had a record series of victories, not just of Democrat candidates, but of progressive candidates, and the sort of gridlock we imposed on ourselves in Congress in 2009 and 2010 when Nancy Pelosi's Congress put, I think, about 400 bills over in the Senate that didn't get dealt with because we were unwilling to change the rules at the very start so that you could have majority rule in the Senate and actually turn those bills into law. We will never know what would have happened. And I, for one, as an organizer and as an activist, have never been inclined to blame other people for my disempowerment. I have always been focused on what can I do to empower myself and people like me to see the change that I need to see for my son, for my daughter, for my community, and for our country. And so I would really encourage all of us to not see the president as Moses, but ourselves as Mosai.
Lynn, we're going over here because it's Reiko's turn, and then we're going to stop because we're really over the time. Go ahead, Reiko.
Hi, my name is Reiko, and I wanted to extend an invitation to everyone here to come to Revolution Books, where I volunteer. It's two blocks away from the UC Berkeley campus. And I wanted to say, long live the spirit of the free speech movement and long live the spirit of Fannie Lou Hamer. And as part of that, you know, I would say that the one thing I agree with Mario Anderson is that voting has been part of the problem of where we are today. Barack Obama, as many of you may have noticed, launched a new war a couple days ago. Hillary Clinton says abortion is tragic and should be rare. Democrats have helped preside over what is now becoming a slow genocide of people. There is 2.5 million people in prison, and in the month July 17 to August 17, 59 people, young men, were killed by the police in this country. I wanted to announce that October is a month of resistance against police brutality, mass incarceration, and the criminalization of a generation. And I wanted to challenge everyone here, each in your own way, to participate in this month. And I heard, I spent part of my summer in Ferguson, which was a total, very enlightening experience for everyone. But from the youth there who are proud about having stood up, who feel like they made a difference in this world, they're issuing a challenge. They're saying, come to Ferguson. The struggle is not over. So if you want to talk to me about that, I know a little bit more about that. But my question is, so 50 years after Freedom Summer, 50 years after the free speech movement, 50 years of systemic oppression, of imperialist wars, why isn't revolution the answer? Why isn't revolution the answer?
Who said that?
Why is revolution the answer?
You know, I would urge that we allow this session to come to a peaceful conclusion. We'll let Ben say or Martha say a few words, and then I'll bring it to a close. Thank you.
The
Please. Go ahead, Ben.
You know, look, why isn't revolution the answer? I haven't got a question like that in like 20 years, and so it's good. You just kind of got me thinking, you know, And what I would say is this, you know, I don't know why in this country we would pick up guns against each other when we can just pick up our ballots and do something with them. I agree. I am sorely frustrated with the state of most representation in this country, and I am absolutely appalled by the extent to which it seems that the votes of so many in Congress and Senate are for sale. And I've sat there in the halls with activists seeking to, for instance, reform our criminal justice system and decided again and again, let's go down to the states and get things done. And then I've shown up in states to organize with activists. We've abolished, you know, we did what Troy asked us to do on death row. When he explained to us, as hard as we fought to save his life, it may just not be possible, but he wanted to make sure that the world would remember his name and they would know what was done to him so they would not do it again. And we saw that social media campaign pushed out by so many activists, like the activists in this room, make the hashtag Too Much Doubt the most tweeted hashtag other than Beyonce's pregnancy in the world in 2011. And we saw public opinion and support for the death penalty fall to its lowest level since 1972 when it was abolished momentarily. And then we saw Connecticut abolish the death penalty despite a high-profile murder case that ordinarily would have made it impossible. And Maryland follow suit as the first state below the Mason-Dixon, which also wouldn't have been possible. And then we realized we could have done that in a year if we had decided to focus like we did that year on that issue. We have tremendous power that we give up all the time. I'm the son of conscientious objectors. My father was a conscientious objector. I was registered as one when I was 5 because Carter started talking about it. And maybe it's because of my household, even though my dad descends from 8 Revolutionary War soldiers, we just studied the ballot. We didn't study the bullet. But when I look around this world and I look at the countries that have had so-called revolutions, none of them have ended up the way people hoped. And when I travel and I come back to this country that my family has struggled mightily in, my mom's family, from slavery through segregation, I go sit with my grandmother who's turning 98 next month, who carries 200 stories of black history told firsthand, who descends from a man who was born a slave, co-founded Virginia State University, and died a state senator. What I'm reminded of is the tremendous power that all of us have that we just squander. And I will never be party to encouraging any American to believe that they are less powerful than they actually are. Because we are some of the most universally empowered people on the planet. And the real crime is that we don't do enough with it.
I want to say that this session, I think, has rewarded itself in that we are addressing some of the most vital, frustrating, and empowering issues that present themselves right now. Beyonce gave a concert not very long ago in which the word feminist was emblazoned in lights behind her. And she made an impassioned plea for equality of gender, equality of race, equality of sexuality. I was just flabbergasted. And there she was. So someone said before about, you know, performers and so forth. And I thought, you know, I teach feminist studies, so it was pretty amazing that, you know, there she was. And one other thing I wanted to say, and it's in the line of what Ben was saying, I came upon very recently in my archive a tape by W.E.B. Du Bois that the librarians put on a CD for me so that I could listen to it. It was on a cassette that was falling apart. It was a speech he gave at Lincoln University in 1941. Lincoln University is in Missouri, 126 miles east of Ferguson. It's really profound to listen, first of all, to his voice again, to hear his voice again. But what he started out with and where he focused was the 62nd Colored Regiment that fought in the Civil War and the Union forces, founded Lincoln University. And I didn't know that, you know. And then he started talking about the role of the Haitian Revolution in preventing Napoleon from trying to launch an attack on the Caribbean and then into the United States. And then he talked about the central role of black folks in Missouri from Dred Scott forward. It was a remarkable speech, as only he could give, 1941. It made me think about the longevity of the struggle. It also made me think of the passion in this room, because what we're really about, from the free speech movement, from Mississippi, Georgia, Alabama, is to end the suffering from the wars and the racism and the incarceration. And if we hold on to that and generate from that appreciation of suffering, the great need for compassion, and the great need never to tire. Must not tire, but keep moving forward as much as we possibly can until we have no breath left with which to move forward. And that's what I think of on the 50th anniversary of the free speech movement. Thank you so much.